This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Steve Kim.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. We're back for another week. Thank you for joining us again, listeners. It's great to have you with us again. Okay, I'm going to lead with an article that I have sent both of you guys. And when I read it, I really couldn't stop laughing at all. It is a story with regards to a guy. He recounts testing his wife's taser on himself. So he bought, this taser at a gun show for his wife. And he said, you know, I think she needs one. It was pocket size, you know, purse size, so she could put it in there, right? And she could use it. So he recounts what happened as he tested.
Now, Terry, after you giggled for a good 10 minutes,
yeah.
I too read this article.
Yeah.
I think that all men can at some level appreciate another man's curiosity with regards to a taser. And one of the things that I found particularly compelling in his story, which I think we've all wondered at one time or another, is how it is that a device that uses just a couple batteries could be so damaging, you know,
damaging.
Stop a yeah. man in his tracks. It's just a couple batteries after all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it all started with me saying to a guy in our office, like, I would like to be tasered. I'd like to feel how that is. Has there been anything with you guys that, like, you would like to experience in that fashion?
Nope.
That's just one of those things. Steve?
Like, even one of those gun ones that shoot out and prong you, you'd be all right with that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'd give it a shot. There's one thing also in the chiropractor's office I always see all the time, and it's just this little, almost like a pen-looking thing, but you push down on the top, and it snaps out. I've always just wanted to take that. I don't know why. I have these urges.
Do you know, if you become a police officer, you have to get tased and maced.
Yeah.
It's part of the training.
Yeah.
What about you, Steve-O?
Well, just about the worst thing that I've done is just a friend daring me to put my tongue on the 9-volt battery, but that's
I've done that before.
Nothing compared to
I can do one better than that. When I was younger, I had my friend shoot a BB gun at my hand to see if I could move my hand before the BB hit me.
Oh,
yeah.
I was still processing it all as soon as I got, like, I got hit. I didn't even flinch. Yeah. I didn't even have a chance to move. It happened so fast. At any rate, there was just a little bit of blood, and I thought, oh, that wasn't too bad. The true story, years later, I'm feeling something in my hand, and I'm thinking, that is just so weird. So I met the doctor, and this is in the U.S. where things happen a little more quickly than here in Canada. And I said, you know, I'm feeling something in my hand. And the doctor says, well, let's go x-ray and take a look. So they did. And sure enough, there was a BB in there. Must have been in there for a solid 5 years.
Really?
Yeah. Wow.
And then they just cut it out, gave it to me. I still have it to this day.
Put it on a necklace.
Yep.
A friend of mine actually said we were in a farmer store out in, actually, in Spruce Grove.
Oh, really? Oh, that's my backyard.
Yeah, your backyard. And so it was a cattle prong. So he says, put your hand on the end of it. I had no idea. He was a farm boy. I wasn't. He says, put your hand on the end of this. It literally is like a taser.
Oh, yeah.
Because he pushed the button.
Oh, man.
And my whole arm just went absolutely numb. Well, so I've sort of experienced that.
Well, what happened to this guy when he tasers himself?
So he tasers himself. He actually put it on his bare skin. Ooh. So, you know, there was a couple different ways you could do it, a 1 second, a 2 second, or a 3 second. And he just decided he was going to do the 1 second, right? So he puts it on his skin, holds it down, but literally you cannot do this by yourself. It's usually done for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's being done to you. you're not holding the device. So in the process of him just wanting to do 1 second, it ended to a point where he held it on there for a lot longer than 1 second because he couldn't get it off. He was like...
He electrocuted himself,
right? In the end, he says, by the time things are all done and I kind of landed on the floor in a fetal position, he said, my bent reading glasses were on top of the TV. The recliner was upside down about 8 feet away from where I was. My face felt like it had been shot up with Novocaine, and my bottom lip weighed 88 pounds. I had no control over my drooling. I saw a faint smoke cloud above my head, which I believe came from my hair. But he says his wife has been laughing to this day and threatens to try it on him again.
Moral of the story, don't tase yourself.
Don't tase yourself.
Yeah.
So it is Terry, one of the funniest things I've read in a long time, and I enjoyed...
Terry, when you decide to get tasered, you just come on over to my desk. I'll help you out. You'll help me.
All right. Let's move on. So we have a interesting, bizarre, but very interesting story that we're going to delve into. The headline states, Indian man to sue parents for giving birth to him. So Raphael Samuel, a Mumbai businessman, told the BBC that it was wrong to bring children into the world because they have to put up with lifelong suffering.
And his parents are both lawyers, from what I understand.
That's right. So he's going to take them to court.
He's going to take them on. Now, you know, when you first hear a story like this, it's easy to just discard something like this and think, oh, wow, this is just nonsense. But the reality is this is a movement. There are a number of people that feel this way. It's known as anti-natalist or natalism.
Yeah.
In which there are different philosophers that advocate for this. David Bentar is one of them from South Africa.
Well, this even goes back even further. Like, I heard that it goes back to the ancient Greek philosophy. Buddhism even has it. Hinduism even has it.
Yeah. So I wasn't surprised to hear that this was coming out of India because, for one, I mean, we'll probably touch on this a little bit later, but there is a big population boom there, right? I mean, India is the second most populous country in the world, and it is projected that they'll be even more so than China in the coming years. And so there is something of an overpopulation crisis there. And the Eastern philosophies that come out of India, whether it's Buddhism or Hinduism, things like that. If you actually look at it, these Eastern worldviews have a very low view of the world. This world is not a good place to be in. This world is something to liberate yourself from. And so in a sense, I thought, okay, yeah, this makes sense that, you know, antinatalism would be so popular in a place like India because the worldview is already there that kind of supports this.
I would argue that this worldview is not just something you'd find in the East, but this is something that you'd find in the West. And the book by David Bentar is Better Never to Have Been Born, The Harm of Coming into Existence. And so this was written in 2006. And this is an idea that is alive and well here in the West. And in fact, I remember hearing this for the first time when I was a kid. As many of you know, I didn't grow up with a lot of hope or a lot of meaning in my life. I grew up in a fairly broken family at first as my parents separated. And I often thought and wondered, especially as we were quite poor, not only why do I exist, but is it even good that I exist? And I remember thinking to myself, in the pointlessness of life, why would you have a child? I very strongly felt, I had the conviction that if you believed that this world was meaningless, and I did, then you had a moral obligation not to bring a child into this meaninglessness. And I had a friend of mine too that he was even in a more broken home than myself, even poorer than my family. He was quite resentful that he had been born, and would often tell me that he wished that he had never been born.
So Dr. Bentar, I mean, he puts it to a moral choice almost, right? Like, he basically says, for reasons of compassion as well, that you should not bring kids into the world.
This becomes a much bigger question. That's why I think this is so important to address, because what we're seeing is just the tip of the iceberg, that this question becomes so much more than, oh, you know, I don't want to have to pay taxes, and I don't have to want to, this is what Samuel talks about. Like, I don't want to work and have to deal with all the suffering and pain and issues of this world. But Bentar takes us in a more challenging direction as he asks, well, what if you get pregnant and find out that you have a child with a disability, whatever that might be? When you choose to have that child, you're choosing for that child to live with suffering. You could really imagine the kind of court cases that could develop in the future from these sorts of ideas that, you know, listen, you found out that I had this or that, and yet you still had me. And so whatever medical bills or whatever challenges I'm facing now, you could imagine somebody suing their parents saying, well, this is actually your responsibility. You knew what was happening and you still chose to have me.
So this Raphael Samuel is doing just that. I mean, he's suing basically his parents to support him for the rest of his life.
Right, because it was their choice to have
it. It was their choice to have
it. So let me ask Steve a question. Steve-o, this is the question that Samuel asks. Isn't forcing a child into this world and forcing it to have a career kidnapping and slavery?
I would probably come back at this from a bigger picture perspective even, because this whole thing revolves around the idea of harm, right? You bring a child into the world full of suffering, and so you're responsible for that harm and suffering that this child will experience. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, what do you even mean by harm and suffering? Because it depends on how you look at the world, really. If you think that this world is nothing more than just particles in motion, then all that you mean by harm and suffering is just certain collocation of atoms or configuration of atoms or subatomic particles, rather. The whole antinatalism thing just falls apart right from the get-go if your worldview is naturalistic, because it's predicated on the idea of harm and suffering and our moral obligations not to subject another human being to that.
Yeah, duty is embedded into this.
Right. So then how do you make sense of duty even in a godless, naturalistic kind of a world? All that duty is just social contract. And what if you don't want to sign the contract? It's just convention. What if you flout that convention? Nobody can justifiably condemn you for it. Everything becomes relativistic. So that's a huge problem. So I would probably want to ask Raphael Samuel, like, what do you even mean by harm and suffering?
I agree with you, Steve. And I think there's something else that we could begin to ask. He makes the point that there's no point to humanity. And he says so many people are suffering. If humanity is extinct, earth and animals would be better. Mm-hmm. They'd certainly be better off. Also, no humans will then suffer. Human existence is totally pointless. Those are some big claims, right? And so it's like, well, how do you know that humanity has no point? How do you know that all of this is pointless? He's making not just worldview claims, but religious claims upon the world, truth claims, that he would need to be able to back that up. I don't see how you could do that.
And this is where I think the Judeo-Christian worldview sets itself apart. He's looking at humanity in a certain way. I've seen this sort of thing from certain radical environmentalists too before, where humanity is seen as this parasite, this destructive force upon the planet. And of course, they bring in this moral presupposition that we ought not to harm the planet, and they have to ground it in something. And I have yet to see a successful attempt of that outside of some kind of a theistic framework.
If I could just interject quickly here, just so make sure we understand what you're saying, is that a person could come along and say, you know what, I want to cut down all the trees, or I want to kill all the animals, right? Now, you think that the world's pointless and that there's no reason for any of this, well, then why would it matter?
Exactly.
If you did those things.
In other words, Raphael Samuel is undermining his own position by saying everything is meaningless. Or if he's saying just human existence is meaningless, well, then it becomes even more difficult. Why just human existence? Now you have to prove that there is meaning in other areas and human existence is meaningless. Now he's taken on double burden of proof, if you will.
So even in Benatar's book as well. He makes four statements in there, and they have this ring of this moral obligation towards the parents, I guess. He says, coming into existence is always a serious harm. It is always morally wrong to have children. It is morally wrong not to abort fetuses at the early stages of gestation. It would be better if, as a result of there being new people, humanity became extinct. So he's using these words of some kind of moral framework in it.
I want to jump in here because this is something we need to think more deeply about that we often forget with regards to just the brokenness of our world. When you read the Bible and you begin in Genesis and you start to see this framework from which our Judeo-Christian worldview is framed, and what you see is that sin, that evil, is really just turning all of this up on its head. And so when you begin to read in Genesis, for example, you know, you read that God created the universe. But, you know, we live in a culture, a secular culture that flips these things on its head, right? So instead of God creating the universe, nothing created the universe. And then we read that humanity is to rule creation. And again, this gets flipped on its head. And no, creation rules humanity. That man was formed from the dust of the earth, and it gets flipped into dust of the earth formed man. And you read this idea of God saying, listen, be fruitful and multiply. And culture has embraced its opposite, right? Don't multiply. And then you get into this morality of, you know, your view of God. And you see this in Genesis chapter 3, that instead of God being wise, the serpent tells you, you know, God's not wise, or questions it. God commands this. And then it's questioned, well, did God command that? And then God is good. And you, again, you get this flipped question. Well, is God good? And I think this is an important concept to understand, because we often in the Bible refer to something called the upside down kingdom. That as Jesus comes in and begins to challenge the worldview, you begin to see that Jesus is flipping everything on its head. And it's not because Jesus is flipping them upside down. It's because they're already upside down in a broken world. And Jesus is flipping them right side up, seeking to orientate us to a correct view of reality. And so when I see these sorts of arguments and when I see these sorts of articles, I'm not surprised by them, because, I mean, this is just further testament to, you know, the broken world that we live in, the rebellious world that we live in that seeks to do the exact opposite of what God has called us to.
This is where I become so thankful that I am a Christian, right? I am proud of the fact that I hold to the Judeo-Christian worldview, because it has such a high view of humanity. Humanity is not just a parasite upon the earth. We bear the image of God. There is dignity in human beings, and so human existence as a whole as well. Whereas some of these other antinatalist and other worldviews would have you believe that we're nothing more than parasites on the earth, and so we need to be eradicated. The only difference here between this kind of a view and, say, some other genocidal kind of a view, let's say the Holocaust or something like that, is that according to the antinatalist view, we should kill our species off voluntarily.
Or if you don't kill off our species, you should only let certain ones survive. It's very much a eugenics understanding of the world. Steve, I agree with what you're saying here. Now, here's what I think is interesting, though, when we think about human dignity, is that this is where you see the antinatalist view becomes quite contradictory within its own worldview. And that is that embedded within it is this understanding that humans do have dignity. And that's why Mr. Samuel's so upset about the suffering that he's experiencing. And he writes this, and I think this is key, quote, "I was a normal kid. One day, I was very frustrated and didn't want to go to school, but my parents kept asking me to go. So I asked them, 'Why did you have me?' And my dad had no answer." And then he writes, "I think if he had been able to answer, maybe I wouldn't have thought this way." I think, again, it just speaks to this idea of human dignity and speaking to this understanding of a broader picture to why we're here and what life is all about.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention that this sort of "I was born without my consent" kind of a thing only works if somebody can actually establish this consent with a child that is not yet born. And so this this movement, it just seems to me right from the get-go just full of contradictions. Like you were pointing out earlier, there is this implicit understanding of human dignity. Whenever we say that something ought not to be done to a human being, in a sense, we're assuming that a human being has some kind of a value. Where is that coming from?
Right, that he shouldn't be kidnapped, that he shouldn't be a slave, and that he shouldn't suffer.
Right. And yet, on the other hand, he is saying there's no meaning in human existence and we should just die off. He is talking out of both sides of his mouth here.
So the question still arises, both to you and to others, like, why would you bring kids into the world on a Christian worldview? In the Bible, it says, right in Genesis, be fruitful and multiply. So the question still comes to us. This is very much a philosophical question. And now we're moving into the Bible as well to answer our
question itself. Well, because I'd say it's at the very heart of the gospel. The gospel message is a message of reconciliation. It's a message of a creation that is in rebellion against God, that, as C.S. Lewis said, has divorced themselves from God, divorcing themselves from one another. And it's a message of reconciliation in that God's desire for us is for us to flourish as human beings. And the understanding that the Bible continues to communicate, and you see Jesus communicating, is that you'll never flourish until you're in right relationship with God and one another. And this then becomes more than just life on this planet and the suffering that we do experience, because now there's a bigger picture to this whole thing where the point of it isn't to suffer. The point of it is to be in right relationship with God, in which there is no suffering. And so I would say then that he's got the right idea, but it's misdirected. Instead of seeing its fulfillment of no suffering, he just wants to cease to exist. Samuel wants to cease to exist so as to avoid that suffering, whereas the Christian worldview sees that as being fulfilled in Christ. So that, you know, there's this greater adventure that's awaiting us all where things are the way they ought to be.
That reminds me, Andy, as you're talking about this, as I was reading that article that you sent me, Terry, as I was reading that, I couldn't help but see the parallel between this kind of a view and Buddhism. According to Buddhism, all is suffering. And how do you stop suffering? Well, you need to ultimately cease to exist. You need to be enlightened, see the world for what it really is, that it's everything is impermanent, everything is transitory, nothing. And so you shouldn't clasp onto anything like it's real, like it is permanent, including your own sense of self. And so ultimately what you want to do is, quote unquote, escape from this world by ceasing to exist.
Which is what the word nirvana means. The etymology of the word is to snuff or blow out a candle. And so ultimately your goal in reaching enlightenment, as you said there, Steve, is to cease to exist. Now, I would argue that there are some parallels in the secular worldview that you have to ask yourself, if you do think that the world is meaningless and that there is no God and that life is all about suffering. I mean, I could imagine people within that worldview having a difficult time justifying having children, because it does come across as an incredibly selfish act, especially given the uncertainty of what's going to happen to that child and what they're going to experience. It doesn't surprise me in light of that, because I would argue that this antinatalist view is well and alive in our secular world of individualism and consumerism. This worldview is well and alive in different ways, whether that be philosophical or just narcissistic or however that might be. And it was interesting because this month, I don't know if you guys noticed this just a couple of days ago, that Hungary announced that they would give women that had more than four children life tax exemption. This isn't the first time we brought this up on the show. There are many countries, Korea, Singapore, and others, that are giving all sorts of incentives to get people to have children. But just notice this dichotomy that's happening, right? You have a world that is very individualistic, sees everything as meaningless, and you shouldn't be surprised that they don't want to bring kids into the world. But yet we also understand that in order for societies to operate and to experience any level of flourishing, it's going to require children. It's going to require human beings. And so there is this tension that's taking place where you have states desiring you know, countries desiring children, and you have individuals that want all of the positive aspects of a culture, flourishing culture, but doesn't want to sacrifice for that in having children. And it's interesting to, as we're watching this play out in multiple different ways in our world around us.
Mm-hmm. One more thing I want to point out, this is a bit of a personal venting moment. Because as I was as I was reading this article, right, Raphael Samuel, he's I think he's got a Facebook page or something like that where he's posting different things where, you know, he's wearing this fake beard and all of that kind of stuff. And he's got all these antinatalist slogans. One of them said, he's talking to children, right? Children, you are basically your parents' entertainment. You know, they had you for selfish reasons. You are their entertainment. They should have gotten a pet or a toy. No, they didn't do that. They had you. You are their entertainment. And I'm thinking to myself, did this guy even raise a child? Any parent would know that raising a child is not just all entertainment. Sometimes it's super frustrating because kids, they're just built to push boundaries. And it's super frustrating sometimes. But you know what? At the end of the day, yes, it comes with suffering, but it also comes with a great reward, both for the parent and the child when the relationship is right.
Yep.
Right? And why should I deny my children that?
I also can't help but feel when you hear those sorts of sentiments that this is the expressions of a rebellious heart towards God. You can imagine these sorts of ideas being hurled at God. How dare you bring me into this world? I'm just your cosmic play toy.
So ultimately, as Christians, we are anti-natalists.
Oh, that we're anti this antinatalism.
Right. Okay. See what I did there?
I see it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It. Although it's still a double negative, so
cancels out. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
All right. But I just wanted to come back to the Christian worldview just for a second here, because we looked at the philosophical. This whole article was a philosophical argument. So Benatar argues more in a philosophical way, and honestly, if you take it to its logical conclusion, you kind of go, okay, that makes sense in the sense that there is a lot of hurt and pain in this world. So if we come back around to the Christian worldview, is it commanded of us to have children, to bring them into this world?
Do we have to have kids?
Is it commanded?
In the cultural mandate, we read that humanity is to go forth and to multiply. I mean, without having children, you don't have society. I mean, you don't have people. And one of the things that is important to understand in the Christian worldview is that life is celebrated and children are celebrated. And it is a good thing to have children. It's a good thing to have family and to grow that family and to see children as a blessing from God and to seek to raise them and to love them and to care for them. However, I don't think that it's commanded in the sense that you're any less of a person or something like that if you didn't have children, because I mean, some people can't have children, and you read about people in the Bible that were unable to have children and they were torn up about the fact that they couldn't have kids. But I think ultimately, and you see this throughout the Bible, it ultimately comes back to a heart issue. But was there desire to care and to love, or was it, you know, some sort of individual narcissism of what they want?
Right.
Well, this gets back to that whole question of, is it better to have loved and lost than to have never loved at all? And I would argue that it's better to have loved and lost. And that ultimately, the greatest love is the love of God. And there are people that are going to reject God. God clearly saw that that was worth the risk.
Yeah. How do we explain it in such a way that they're going to desire that? What we have.
Terry, I think that that's why this question, that, and that's one of the reasons why I brought up Hungary. That's why I think it's so ridiculous when a country is offering you financial reasons to have a children. Having children is foundational to a worldview. It's not economical. We've yet to see this work, by the way. We have yet to see a country give you some sort of financial benefits for having children. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to sacrifice now and have these kids and love them because I'm going to be tax free for the rest of my life. You know, it just doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that ultimately the message of Christianity is one of changing the way that you see the world. So this comes back to the question of the gospel, that when we engage with the world, we're engaging in the gospel and we're introducing people to hope that's found in Christ. And their worldview begins to be shaped anew, as Paul says in Colossians, that they're being renewed in the image of their creator, right? That upside down kingdom, you know, things are being flipped right side up again as they're starting to see the way the world was meant to be through Christ.
We are going to have to end it here. But we encourage you as listeners to go and continue to give us reviews and ratings on iTunes. We appreciate those that have done that. And it helps those that are looking for a podcast to listen to. One listener left a review. B. Dunsky says, he says, love this podcast. It is insightful, balanced, and respectful of even positions not their own. I am grateful to have discovered it. Thank you, listeners, for joining us again. The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more things to think about.